The ninth parak of Baba Basra is a direct continuation of the prior parak in discussing the laws of Yerusha of inheritance. And in fact, the first Mishnah is a direct continuation of the last Mishnah that we just had at the end of the eighth parak in discussing what happens when a father passes away and there are sons and daughters. Sons have a right to Yerusha, and daughters, via the Tnai, the Ketubah, condition of the Ketubah, the father has a requirement to continue supporting them. And he has to support them, for example, making sure they have enough for their food, for their clothing, shelter, medicine, their needs. What happens if there's a clash between the two? In other words, there's not enough assets for the sons to get a Yerusha, and also for the support of the daughters to continue until they reach the age of 12 and a half, or when they get engaged, Erusin, whichever comes earlier. So the Mishnah says as follows, Misha meis v'hiniach bani mabana. Somebody passes away and he has both boys and girls, daughters and sons. Bizman shanachasim rumbim, and a time when there is sufficient in the estate. There are sufficient assets. Habanim yirshu v'habonos yizona. The sons will have the Yerusha, and the daughters will continue eating from that Yerusha. They will be supported, and the sons will be required to continue making those maintenance supports until the girls reach of age that they no longer are required to be supported. However, nechasim muatim, if there are not many assets, it's not enough assets to support the women and to support the girls until they reach of age. Habonos yizona, the girls will take priority. They have their maintenance that they're going to receive. V'habanim yishalu ala psachim, and the sons will have to go and they'll have to beg. If there's a little bit Yerusha for them, they can get that Yerusha, and when they want out, they are responsible for themselves. In other words, we see the first Tana, the Mishnah Tana Kama, is saying that the girls would have priority. Admon, who is another Tana, disagrees. Admon Omer Bishvil Shani Zachar Hifsadeti, which this sounds like is because I'm male, I lose out. But what is really going on here, the question that Admon says is, how can this possibly be? The Torah says that boys have Yerusha. That's a Deoraisa right. And in fact, girls, they have a maintenance payment that's rabbinic in nature. So why would that trump our right to Yerusha? Now, the opinion of Admon is really that they should both share equally. The boys and the girls should share the support equally. And when that support runs out, when the money runs out, they'll all have to fend for themselves. But let's not give priority to girls if the Torah says that the Yerusha should go to boys. Amar Rabbi Gamliel, Roe Ani Estivre Admon. Rabbi Gamliel, the third Tana, says, I agree with Admon on this. It makes sense what he's saying. Nonetheless, we do not paskin like Admon. We paskin the halacha that the girls will have priority. If there's not enough in the assets of the estate, they will go first before the boys get their Yerusha. Mishnah Beis deals with the unusual situation of when somebody has a child who is a tumtum. Tumtum literally means stopped up. And what a tumtum is that there's an extra piece of flesh that covers up the private parts of the body that cannot be told if this is a male or a female. So obviously that has implications for Yerusha. Will this tumtum inherit as a son and get a Yerusha, or will he have a right to maintenance payments like a daughter until 12 and a half years old, or Erusin, whichever comes earlier? So the Mishnah says, Hiniach bani mubanos v'tumtum. If somebody left over, he passed away, and he was survived by sons, daughters, and a tumtum. So how is that tumtum going to be treated? Bizman shanachasim merubim, if there is a large estate sufficient to give both Yerusha and maintenance, and Yerusha to the boys and maintenance to the girls, hazacharim dochin oso eitzel nekeva. So the men are going to say, we're going to treat you like one of the girls. You can get maintenance payments, but if you want a Yerusha, there's a concept, hamotzi mechavero alav haraya, you'd have to prove that you should be treated like a boy, and you don't have the proof necessary to in order to participate in the Yerusha. And conversely, nechasim muatim, if there is only a little bit in the estate, only enough to cover the maintenance supports of the girls, and the boys are not going to be dividing any assets as Yerusha, hanekevos dochoso. So here the nekevos, the girls, would say to this tumtum, Eitzel Nesacharim, you go Eitzel Nesacharim. In other words, you're not going to get anything with us in our maintenance payments. Hamotzi mechavero alav araya. If you want to be paid out something, you'd have to bring a proof. You don't have a proof that you're a female, so you would be treated as one of the boys, not getting any Yerusha, and certainly not getting maintenance payments from us. The second part of the Mishnah deals with an unrelated issue. We're going back to the discussion of a Shechiv Meira, somebody who's deathly ill. Typically, when you want to give a matanah, you need a kinyan, but if we have somebody who's deathly ill, we adhere to his last will and testament, we will fulfill his wishes, even in the absence of a kinyan. So, for example, if he gives a gift on his deathbed, we will adhere to his wishes, even if in the future it would have been divided. Had he not given that gift, the assets would have been divided differently amongst his children based on the halachas of Yerusha. We are nonetheless going to give the gift. If he earmarks it for a specific child, for example, we will certainly adhere to the wishes. So here, we're going to combine that concept with the discussion of a tumtum in a little bit. What happens if he has a gift and one of the children is a tumtum? So we're going to start out in a more normal case. Ha'omer, somebody who's deathly ill, a shchiv meira, im teled ishti zachar yitol maneh. He says, if my wife who's expecting, if she gives birth to a boy, he will get an extra gift of 100 zuz. Yalda zachar no telmaneh. If indeed she has a boy, he will receive an additional gift of 100 zuz. Nekeva, if he says, the shchiv meira says, if my wife who is expecting has a baby girl, ma'atayim, that baby girl will get a special gift of 200 zuz. Yalda nekeva no telas ma'atayim. If she does have a baby girl, she will indeed receive that gift of 200. Im zachar maneh, im nekeva ma'asayim. If he says, if it's going to be a boy, it will be 100. If it's a girl, it's going to be 200. What happens if he has twins? V'yalda zachar nekeva. He had both a boy and a girl unexpectedly. Mazel tov and mazel tov. Zachar no tel maneh. So the boy is going to get 100, v'hanekeva no telas ma'asayim, and the girl is going to get 200. Yalda tumtum, in that same situation when he says, if I'm going to have a baby boy, it's going to get this gift, I'm going to have a baby girl, my wife is going to have a girl, it's going to be this gift, and it became a tumtum, and you don't know, is it a boy or a girl? Yalda tumtum ain't a nota, because we don't know if it's a boy or a girl, it's not going to get anything. Im amar kol ma sheteled ish de yitol, if he says, anything that my wife gives birth to will get XYZ gift, 100, 200, hareza yitol, even if it's a tumtum, it will receive the gift, because it is certainly one of the two. The Mishnah then concludes, v'im ein sham yoresh elahu, if there's no other yoshim except the tumtum, yoresh esakol, that tumtum will receive everything. The only issues that we were talking about in the beginning of the Mishnah, that the boys push him to the girls, the girls push the tumtum to the boys, is because there was no proof whether it was a zachar and a keva, is this a boy or a girl. But if it's the sole inheritor, then obviously the tumtum would receive everything as the Yerusha. Mishnah Gimel deals with an interesting scenario that the estate of a deceased has not been divided yet, and those who are going to be inheriting the estate work in order to increase the value of the estate. And the question that we deal with is, if some of those who are going to inherit did the work and some do not do the work, who gets the benefit of the increased value of the estate? So the Mishnah says as follows, Hiniach banim gedolim uktanim. The deceased left sons, he was survived by sons, some were younger, some were older. Hishpichu gedolim etach nechastim, and it was the older sons who worked and increased the value of the estate. So for example, it was worth 50 when the father passed away and they got to work, and now it's worth 75. Hishpichu laemtza. The Mishnah says that increase in 20 of value is for the benefit of all of those who are going to be inheriting, including the younger sons, not only the older sons who did the work. Now, the Gemara explains what this is talking about, that it goes to the Emsa, that it goes to all of them and they all share equally, is when those older sons hired workers. They didn't do the work themselves, they hired workers, and it was paid for by the estate. However, if they did the work themselves, or they paid for the workers themselves, not via the estate, then they themselves would keep that increase in value of 20. Now, nonetheless, despite that, there is a scenario, the Mishnah continues, that even if the older ones just do the work, and they do hire others to do the work on their behalf, and the estate pays for it, Im amru reuma shehiniach lanu abba. If they say, look at the value of it today, and we're going to work on this, we're going to put in our time and effort and increase the value of the property, hare anu osim v'ochlim, we expect it to work and get paid for the increase, hishpichu la'atzman. In that case, when they stated to Abasin up front that their expectation is to get paid, then they would keep that increase in value. If it was the 20 that we mentioned, they would keep that amount. The Seifa deals with a very similar situation. In this case, it's talking about a wife that inherits the husband, and typically a wife doesn't inherit the husband, but in our situation what's going on is this wife was in fact also a niece of her husband. In other words, the husband had a brother, the brother passed away, and the husband himself had no closer inheritors other than his three nieces, one of which was his wife. So the Mishnah says as follows, "Nechein ha'isha hishish bicha es anachasim." Same thing applies when you have a wife, husband passed away, she's one of three nieces that will be inheriting the estate. Hishbicha la'emtza, the increase in the value of the estate will be shared by those inheritors, those three nieces. However, im amra ru'uma she'niach libali, if she says up front, in front of a basting, look, this is the value of the estate, I am going to be working to increase the value, hare ani osev ocheles, and my expectation is that I'm going to work and I'm going to personally keep the value of the increase of the estate and not share that. The Mishnah says that the same thing applies here. Hishpicha le'amtz atzma, that shevach, that increase, the improvement in the value, that she will keep for herself personally. Mishnah Dalet continues our discussion of what is considered an estate revenue or an expense of the estate before the brothers who are inheriting the assets of their father have actually divided up the assets. So the estate is still whole. And the question is, what is considered communal and what is considered individual property of the various brothers who are inheriting? So the Mishnah says, Ha'achin hashutafim, we're talking about brothers, the assets of the estate have not been divided up. For example, they received an inheritance of the family company. Shenafal echad mehen lu'umonos, an independent. Independent of that, one of the brothers received an offer from the government for very lucrative employment. The Mishnah says, Nafa le'emsa, anything he's paid for that is going to be divided up into the estate. It goes into the estate, and the brothers will divide it equally. The Gemara explains what's going on here is if the brother actually received that appointment because of the father or because of the prominence of the family, for example. But if he received it of his own, because he was known or he was had a specialty or whatever it is, because of his own independent strengths, then he would be able to keep that compensation. Otherwise, it goes into the family pot. Chalav and Yisrab, and continuing in the Mishnah, if one of the brothers got sick and he had significant medical bills, Baruch Hashem, he had a refuah shalema, who pays for those medical expenses? Nisrap and Mishal Atzmo, he actually has to bear those expenses personally. What's going on here in the Mishnah is if he got sick because of his negligence, he didn't take care of himself, for example, then he has to bear the cost himself. Otherwise, if it's not because of his own negligence, then that would be an expense of the estate and would be covered by the collective estate and not him personally. The Mishnah then continues a fascinating concept. In the time of Chazal, what used to be is when somebody was getting married, the way that the costs of the marriage, of the expenses of the wedding were covered and all the associated costs, is that the friends of the groom would participate. They would not only celebrate with the chuppah and all the other festivities, but they would financially participate. It was actually a requirement. And anyone who did participate, the expectation was that those grooms that they funded, those grooms would fund them when they had their marriages. And in fact, it was so that it was considered just a loan. When the friends of the groom funded his marriage, it was effectively viewed as giving him a loan to pay for his marriage, and then he would be obligated, required in turn, to pay for their respective marriages. So ha'achin sha'asu miktsasan shushvinus bechayeav. What's talking about it, there were some brothers that their father paid. The brothers can't act independently of the father if it's his assets. And what happened was there were brothers, we'll say Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, who were some of the brothers of Yaakov. And Yaakov here paid for their friend's marriage as was required by the custom then. So for example, Moshe got married, who was Reuven's friend. So Reuven's father, Yaakov, funded the portion of Moshe's wedding. And then Yaakov passes away. And now it's Reuven's turn to get married. So Reuven's friend Moshe, Reuven, funded Moshe's wedding. Now it's Moshe's turn to reciprocate. Moshe repays the wedding and he's paying for Reuven's wedding. The question is, those payments, do they go to Reuven or do those go into the estate of Yaakov? Because it was really Yaakov who funded those amounts to pay for Moshe's wedding. So ha'achin sha'asu miktsasan shushvinus bechayayav. Yaakov, the father of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, paid for the weddings of some of their friends, and now those friends are reciprocating chazra shushvinus, and now those funds are coming back and they're being paid to the brothers whose wedding it is. Chazra le'emtza, those funds indeed belong not to Reuven, who is now getting married, but that has to go into the estate of Yaakov to be evenly split by the brothers. Why? Shashru shusvinus, because these types of gifts, when these friends of the grooms would pay, of the groom would pay for his wedding, nigvis bebeistin, upon the return trip, when the funder, the lender, who participated in somebody else's wedding, that groom is now has to, the prior groom now has to participate in his friend's wedding, that was collectible and abasing, that is viewed as a loan and has to be returned. So that's the reason that it has to be paid back into the estate. It was funded as a loan to the friends of Reuven, to Moshe in our scenario. Now when Moshe is funding back Reuven's wedding, that is a repayment of a loan that it was actually given by Yaakov, Reuven's father, and it has to go into the estate to be divided by the brothers. However, on the other hand, if the initial gift was not a payment like a loan that was expected, a repayment when Reuven got married, but rather was a simple wedding gift without any expectation of giving it as a loan that would be repaid, that's a different scenario. Aval hasholeach lechaveiro kadeh yayin vekadeh shemen. If Reuven sent a simple wedding gift to Moshe, he gave him a bottle of wine, whatever it is, and it wasn't as the expectation of being repaid. Here, Reuven didn't go and celebrate and wasn't one of the groom's greatest friends that's funding and will get this repayment. When there is a return trip, meaning Moshe now, when Reuven is getting married, Moshe also wants to give him a wedding gift, but not as a repayment. Ein nigves bebeistin, if Moshe would not return the wedding gift, Reuven cannot go and collect that wedding gift in a basin. It wasn't in, as a loan. Nibnei she'ein shehen gemilus chasadim. It was simply a nice gift to give, but not as a loan. In these cases, when Moshe would give a return gift to Reuven, it wasn't because he's repaying a loan, then that would go directly to Reuven. That gift would not be required to be returned to the estate to be divided by the brothers. Mishnah He is a continuation of Mishnah Dalet because it continues discussing a form of wedding gifts, and it's in our perek for that reason, even though it doesn't relate to the laws of Yerusha. In the time of Chazal, they used to divide up the Erusin, also called the Kiddushin, from the Nisuin. So there was a betrothal, and that at some point later there was the actual Nisuin. Right after the betrothal, the Erusin, there was a custom that the Chassan would send his Kala some gifts. It could have been nice jewelry or nice food, whatever it may be. It was the day after the Kiddushin, after the Erusin, the betrothal, he would send these gifts. And there were also occasions where there would be a celebratory Seuda in the house of his future father-in-law. So the Mishnah discusses if he sent those gifts, which are called Sivlonos, and unfortunately the wedding fell through, he decided to not move forward, or if he passes away or something like that before the actual Nisuin, what happens with those gifts? Can he or his estate get those gifts back? So the Mishnah says, Hasholeach sivlonos lebeis chamiv. If we have the chassan and he sends these gifts to his father-in-law's house, and it's for purposes of his kala, shalach sham mea maneh. Even if he sent a significant, a tremendous gift, very expensive gift, va'achal sham su'udas chassan, Hasan Afila Bedinar, as long as he participated in that Su'uda the day after the betrothal. He went and celebrated, and even if he didn't eat that much there, Einan Nigbin, he cannot, if the wedding falls through, he is not able to recollect on those gifts. And the concept here is because he was in the festivities and enjoying himself on the day of the festivities, he gave the gift, he participated in that su'uda, we impute to him that he was mochel, that he was forgiving those gifts, that she could keep them under any circumstances. Now, an important point here is that this Mishnah is talking about that he did not qualify his intentions when it comes to those gifts. He did not say, I'm going to want these gifts back or not want them back if things fall through. It was just unstated in that situation. If he participates in that su'uda, we are going to impute to him that he is mochel on those gifts. However, lo achal sham su'udas chasan, if he did not participate in that su'uda, he was not mochel on those gifts. Hare elu nigbin, if the wedding falls through, he can recollect those gifts because he only gave them with the intention of getting married. The Seifa of our Mishnah deals not with where he was stam, where he didn't state his intentions, but indeed he did state his intentions. And we're going to try to work that in to the language of the Mishnah and the explanation of the Mishnah, even though it's not going to fit exactly perfectly. But this is what the commentaries explain this Mishnah. Shoshalach sivlonos merubin. If this chasson, if he sent a lot of gifts, and in other words, the intention is not that he sent a lot of gifts, but he specifically said that his intention is that these gifts that he is sending the day after the get betrothed, his intention is that she should bring them with him, with her, when they get married to the house that they're going to live in together as husband and wife. And even if it's not a lot, but it would be treated as if it's a lot because his intention is not that she simply use it in her father's house, but to bring it into the marriage when they get married. So shalach sivlonos merubin shiyachzru ima lebeis bala, that she would bring, whether it's a lot or a little, it would be treated as a lot, that she's going to bring when they get married. Harelu nigbin, if things fall through, because he stated his intention was that she should bring these gifts with her when they get married, if the marriage indeed does unfortunately fall through, he would be able to recollect those gifts. In contrast, sivlonos muatim, if it wasn't a lot of gifts, it doesn't mean literally wasn't a lot of gifts, but rather what it means is even if it were a lot of gifts, but his stated purpose was that she should use these only in her father's house, the expectation and statement was not that she should bring them to their house together when they get married. So shetishtamesh bahen bebeis avia, she would use it only in her father's house. Einan nigbin, if the marriage falls through because the stated purpose was for her to have it in her father's house, not to bring it with her, it wasn't necessary to bring it along. Therefore, if things fall through, he would not have the right, the ability to collect those gifts if things unfortunately did not culminate in a marriage. Mishnah Vav gets back to a concept that we've seen in the past in a number of Mishnais of a Shchiv Meira, somebody who's deathly ill, and he gives away his assets, typically to give a gift. We have formalities in Halacha, it should be written, there has to be a kinyan to make it binding. When it comes to a Shchiv Meira, Dive Shchiv Meira, Kiksuvi Mekumasurin, the concept here is a Shchiv Meira, somebody who's on his deathbed, deathly ill, his words, his request of doing something, it's as if it's written and sealed, and a kinyan is not necessary. So here we are going to qualify that concept. Shchiv Meira, Shekasav kol nechasav la'acherim, the Shchiv Meira wrote all of his assets to somebody else. Here's a gift. This is when he was deathly ill. Vishir karka kolshu, but he left a tiny amount of either karka or metalteling, personal property, real property to himself. And he had Baruch Hashem a refuah shalema, and he got better. Matanaso kayemes, he is required to go forward with that gift. In other words, the recipient can enforce that gift, and the Shchiv Meira, who is now healthy, cannot claim, I only gave it away because I was deathly ill, now I want it back. Because we see that he left an asset, even a small asset to himself, he had the expectation at the time, even if remote, that he would have a refuah shalema. So now at this point, that he did have the refuah shalema, he cannot say, I didn't at all anticipate having a refuah shalema, now that I did, I want the gift back. However, says the Mishnah, Lo Shir Karka Kolshu, if he didn't leave anything to himself, he was giving it all away, and then he had Refuah Shalema, that's when he can say, Ein Matana So Kayemes, that's when we say that he cannot be forced to go forward with that gift, because we see he gave it all away, his intention was, he's giving it away because he had full expectation of passing away, now that he had Baruch Hashem Refuah Shalema, that gift would not be effective, he would be able to retain those assets. The Mishnah now continues in discussing somebody who gave away all of his assets, but when he gave it away, this is, happens later on, it's not clear at the time if he indeed was a Shechiv Meira and can now claim my gift should not be effective because I had a Refuah Shleima, or if he was not a Shechiv Meira at all, he was healthy and accordingly his gift would be effective. Here we're talking about that it did accord with the formalities. It was in writing and there was a kinyan. So the Mishnah says, Lokasa Bashchiv Meira, in the document giving over the ownership, the gift, the recipients, it did not state he's a Shchiv Meira. And so it's a little bit vague what the situation is. Hu Omer Shchiv Meira Haya. And at the time now he has a Refuah Shleima. He says, when I gave that gift, I was deathly ill. And now that I have a Refuah Shleima, this gift, I cannot be forced to give this gift. And the recipients say, Vehen Omrim Bari Haya, you weren't a Shechiv Meira, you were healthy, you were clear of mind, and you wrote it, we went through all the formalities, now that, now you can't say in retrospect that I was a Shechiv Meira, you were healthy when you gave it, and the gift is effective. So the discussion now is who has to bring a proof to their claim. Does the person who gave the gift have to prove he's a Shechiv Meira, or do the recipients have to prove that he was healthy, and therefore he cannot renege on the gift? So the Mishnah says, Tzarech lahavi ra'aya shahaya Shechiv Meira divrei Rabbi Meir. The burden of proof is on the individual who owned the assets, because right now he's healthy. This is the view of Rabbi Meir. We're going to assume he has a chazaka now, he's healthy. We're going to assume that his chazaka now is going to be the same as he was prior. We have to assume that prior to this also, he was in the same situation as being healthy. So he would have to bring the proof that he was a Shechiv Meira. Otherwise, the recipients of the gift can enforce the gift and get possession of the assets. But Chachamim Omrim, they have a different view. Hamotzi Mechaveiro Alav HaRa'aya, those who want to take possession of assets, this is a concept we see in a number of places, they have to bring the proof. In other words, because the original owner of the property, he is in possession still, and they want to get possession, they would have to bring the proof that indeed he was healthy at the time of the gift, and therefore he cannot renege on the gift claiming that he was a Shechiv Meira. Mishnah Zayin is going to continue our discussion of the concept of a Shechiv Meira, somebody who is deathly ill, not needing to adhere to the formal requirements of a kinyan and a writing in order for his desires to be fulfilled and binding halachically. So there we're going to see a dissenting view now. Hamechalek nechasav al piv, somebody who wants to give away his assets, how does he actually do that? How does he effectuate it? So Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Echad Bari ve'echad Mesukan, somebody, whether he is healthy or Mesukan, is a Shechiv Meira. Rabbi Eliezer of the view that we don't adhere to the last will and testament of the Shechiv Meira unless he adheres to the legal requirements of a formal kinyan, just like anyone else. We don't dispense with the halachic requirements of kinyanim. So he says, whether it's a healthy person or a Shechiv Meira, nechasim sheyesh lehem achrayus, if we're talking about a transfer of real property, the only three ways to do it, it's a mishnah and kiddushin, but we won't go into the details of the various kinyanim, but the kinyanim are niknim, you acquire it via kesef, bekesef, through a document, through a shtar, or by chazaka, actually having certain possession, possessing it in certain ways. You have to go through the formalities, even if it's a Shechiv Meira. V'she'ein lehen achrayut, and if it's talking about movable property, not real property, ein niknin ela b'mishicha, it's only acquired through a kinyan mishicha, drawing it towards yourself. It's also, there are other ways to be koned also, which we don't have to get into right now. But the important point is we see the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer that a Shechiv Meira also must adhere to the formal requirements of making a kinyan. Otherwise, his wishes are not going to be adhered to. We don't have to adhere to it. And the recipient indeed cannot enforce that gift if that Shechiv Meira has a Refuah Shleima. Amrullah, but the other Tanaim disagree with Rabbi Eliezer, and they're going to bring a proof of a psak din that even though there was only verbal instructions from a shchiv meira, those verbal instructions, even absent of kinyan, were adhered to. Ma'ase bi'iman shel b'nei Rochel. There was a situation, the mother of the children of Rochel. Rochel was a father, and these two sons, or multiple sons, two, three, however many, their mother was a shchiv meira, she was about to pass away, and these sons, we'll say two sons, were rishayim. Shahai sachola, she was not well. Va'amra tnu kveinasi libiti. And she says, I am bequeathing my kveina. See, it's either a very expensive brooch with jewels, or it's a very expensive shawl, some very expensive item, even though my daughter should not be inheriting me, but I'm going to give it to her as a gift nonetheless. V'hibishneim asar maneh, and it's very expensive. It's shneim asar 12 maneh. V'mason, she cast away. Now the son should be inheriting. V'kimu estvareh, and nonetheless, chachamim at that time, they adhered to her wish. There's a shchiv meira. This is the proof that they're bringing, that we paskin that is shchiv meira, the desires of shchiv meira keksuvi mekumesurin. You don't need to have a formal kinyan. Amar lehen. So here Rabbi Eliezer responds back to Rabbi Eliezer, who requires a formal kinyan even from a shchiv meira. Bnei Rochel tik berem imam. You're talking about Bnei Rochel. They were reshaim. They should bury their mother. It's a phrase here that it means that Chazal, even though typically they do require, like me, says Rabbi Eliezer, a formal kinyan even from a shchiv meira, but in that specific situation, because the children of Rochel, they were reshaim, Chazal wanted to keep the assets away from them. Accordingly, they dispensed with the kinyan requirement of the shchiv meira that is typically required. But the rule is, with that minor exception, that the divrei shchiv meira, the shchiv meira, also require a formal kinyan. Now we're going to have a third opinion. The first opinion was that divrei shchiv meira keksuvim mekumesurim, you don't really require a formal kinyan by a shchiv meira. The second opinion was Rabbi Eliezer, who requires a formal kinyan from a shchiv meira, just like a healthy person. And now v'chachamim omrim, the view of chachamim b'shabes dvarav kayamim, if a shchiv meira makes instructions, you can't write, you cannot do a kinyan on Shabbos. So we're going to dispense with those requirements. Shmibnei shein yachol lichtov, we are not able to write on Shabbos. His concern was, you have somebody deathly ill, they are going to get very, very agitated and maybe even bring the death quicker, knowing they may have anxiety, knowing that their desires, last will and testament, cannot be fulfilled because there's no writing. So Chazal said, we're going to be lenient. If it's Shabbos, if the instructions are given, we're going to dispense with the formal requirements of writing and a kinyan. But if it's during the weekday, even a shchiv meira is going to be required, just like a healthy person, like Rabbi Eliezer said, to have the formal kinyanim. Rabbi Yeshua is going to disagree now. Rabbi Yeshua Omer b'Shabbos Amru. If Chazal dispensed with the requirements of a kinyan on Shabbos and he had no other way to transfer it on Shabbos, and nonetheless they said we can be lenient and transfer without a kinyan, kal v'chomer b'chol, certainly on a chol where you have other ways to transfer it, for example, a writing and a kinyan, they are also going to dispense with the requirements of the formalities and be lenient and follow the instructions of the shchiv meira, even in the absence of a kinyan. Now we're going to have an additional addendum to our Mishnah that follows a similar logic of what we just saw with Rabbi Yeshua. So with the discussion here is a katan who is a minor. He's not able to acquire something for himself. If somebody wants to give him a gift, for example, he would need somebody above the age of a minor in order to acquire it for himself. So kiyotze bo zakin l'katan. Somebody can be zoche, can acquire an object for a minor, even though the minor cannot legally acquire it for himself. Ve'ein zachin legadol, but you can't do it on behalf of a gadol. A gadol can do it for himself, but somebody else cannot do it on his behalf. Rabbi Yeshua disagrees. Rabbi Yeshua Omer lekatan amru, if we are going to be lenient for a katan and say somebody else can be zoche, acquire something on his behalf, even though he himself doesn't have the power to do that, kal v'chomer legadol, certainly we are going to enable somebody else to be acquire something for a gadol. The gadol can do it himself. Certainly somebody else can acquire that object on behalf of that adult individual. Mishnah Ches, and the same thing for Mishnah Tes and Yud. These are the last three Mishnayos of our Perek, continue dealing with Yerusha issues, and in particular they have a question of if two people passed away, two relatives passed away, and it's not clear who passed away first and who passed away second, and there are different people who would yoresh them or have claims to their property. What do we do in those situations? So the Mishnah says as follows, Nafal habayis alav ve'alaviv. If there is a building that collapsed on a father and a son, the father will refer to as Yaakov and the son as Reuven, and it's not clear which of them passed away first and which second. Or alav al morishav, or a different situation. It was Reuven and somebody other relative of Reuven that he would get a Yerusha from. V'haisa alav ksubas isha ubalchav. In our scenario, this Reuven, the proverbial Reuven, has a creditor. He also has a wife whose ksuba has to be paid out, and Reuven himself has no assets. So the only way that the creditor and the wife, the ex-wife, will get paid out is if he is the one who passes away second and receives a Yerusha from his father, even for that small amount of time until he passes away. So now we have claims who passed away first, who passed away second, and no one really knows. They're just saying, we think. It's possible that X passed away first, X passed away second. So the claims go as follows. Yorshe Ha'av Omrim, the Yorshe, the inheritors of the father. In other words, the brothers of Reuven make the following claim. They're going to be inheriting. Yorshe Ha'av Omrim Haben Meis Rishon. Reuven passed away first. Va'acharkach Meisav. And afterward, our father passed away. Afterward, Yaakov passed away. In other words, Reuven never participated in a portion of the Yerusha. And the creditors of Reuven, the wife who has to get paid out her ksuba, they would not participate in the division of the estate of our father Yaakov. On the other hand, Ba'alei Hachov Omrim, the creditors, in other words, the creditor and the wife who has to get paid out her ksuva, Ba'alei Hachov Omrim Ha'av Meis Rishon. In fact, that's not correct. The father passed away first, and in other words, Yaakov passed away first, V'acharkach Meis Haben, and thereafter, Reuven passed away. In other words, Reuven received, even for a very short time, a Yerusha, participation in the Yerusha, and we would be able to be paid out of the Yerusha via Reuven. So now we have a machlokes who is correct. Beishamai Omrim Yachloki. Beishamai is of the view that literally they divide it up. In other words, the creditors, assuming that there is enough in the estate of Yaakov's estate to be able to cover their claims, both the creditor and the ksuba, to be paid out, they would get half of what they are owed. What's the concept here? So here the concept receives half of the amount they're owed, and the heirs of Yaakov will receive the balance of the estate. On the other hand, Beis Hillel disagrees. Beis Hillel omrim nechasim beschez kasan. The nechasim, those assets, they have a chazakah that they are owned by Yaakov. And we have a concept here that if somebody wants to motzi mechavero alav haraya, if somebody wants to acquire assets for somebody who is in possession, he has to bring a proof. In this situation, it's the creditor, the ex-wife, who want to get played out because of their claims against Reuven. Reuven did not have any assets, so they have to make a claim against the estate. And they have to prove, in other words, that Reuven was the one who passed away later and has a claim to the Yerusha, but because they have no proof for that claim, they would get nothing, and the brothers of Reuven, they would be the inheritors of the full estate. Mishnah Tes continues Mishnah Ches in discussing when there is an unfortunate death of two individuals who are related, and it's unclear who is Yoresh who, what is the situation. So our Mishnah says as follows, Nafal habayis alav al ishto. Unfortunately, a building fell or whatever other calamity occurred, and a husband and wife pass away almost at the same time, and it's unclear who passed away first and who passed away second, and different groups have interest in financially in the difference in who passed away at a different time. So Yorshe Abal Omrim Ha'isha Mesa Rishona. So the inheritors of the husband, for example, if he has sons from a previous wife, Yorshe Habal, so those are his Yorshim. Omrim Ha'isha Mesa Rishona, the wife passed away first, va'acharkach mesabal, and then thereafter our father passed away. In other words, what they're claiming is any individual assets that she had, because she passed away first, they were inherited by our father, and accordingly, we would be yorshim, we would be inheriting those assets, not only from our father, but also of his wife. And the other claimant, Yorshe Aisha, anyone who would be Yoresh, her descendants, inheritors, Omrim Haba'al Meis Rishon, their claim is that the husband passed away first, Vaharkach Meis HaYisha, and only thereafter did she pass away. So indeed, again, we have a machlokes. Beis Shammai Omrim Yachloku, any of those assets are going to be divided by the two groups of claimants, the husband's inheritors and the wife's inheritors, because they both have the same claim to the assets. Not one claim is stronger than the other, so they should divide up her assets. Beis Hillel disagrees, and before we get into Beis Hillel, we're going to just introduce a few concepts. We are talking about three categories of assets that she would have a claim to. Number one is the Nichzei Tzon Ubarzal. This is a property, various types of property that she brought into the marriage when she got married. And it is recorded in the ksuba. In other words, the husband has achrayus, he has responsibility throughout the marriage. He has the benefit to use those assets. But also, if there is a divorce or if he dies before she does, she has to get paid out those assets or the value of those assets. So those are the nichnei son barzel. A second category of property is nichse milog. That is property, again, that she brings in, but this is not recorded in her ksuba. He does not have responsibility for it, so she's just more in her property than his. He happens to have use of it during their marriage, but he doesn't have any legal responsibility for those assets because it's more hers than his. And last, the third category is the ksuba amount itself, the amount that's included in the ksuba that says if there is the husband passes away, she will get paid X. That is the third category of assets we're talking about. So Beis Hillel comes and says, you don't just divide up the assets, these categories between the two. You have to look at each class separately. A Beis Hillel Omrim Nechasim Bechezkasan is talking about the Nichzei Tzon Ubarzel that is recorded in the Ksuba, and he has achrayus, he has responsibility for it. Those assets, because they are effectively both owned by both parties, he has responsibility for them, and she has to get paid out of them. So because of that, these two classes of claimants will divide up the Nichzei Tzon Ubarzel between them. When it comes to the ksuba, the amount that is recorded in the ksuba that he would have to pay her upon his death, Bechezkas Yorshei Habal, because they are his responsibility. In other words, he has the chazak, he has the achrayas, responsibility to pay it out. We would say that those assets would remain with the one who is in possession and has achrayus on those assets. So that's category number two. And in contrast, nechasim shanichnasim v'hayotzim ima, in other words, the nichse milog that is not recorded in the ksuba, she brought it into the marriage, she keeps it, he may have had certain uses of it, but it's really intrinsically her asset, those becheskas yorshe ha'av, which means those would go to her inheritors and not to his. Mishnah Yud discusses a third scenario of when two relatives pass away from an accident, but it is unclear which passed away first. In our scenario, we're talking about a mother and a son. She happened to not have been married at the time of the accident, and the son who dies at the same time, approximately at the same time, was her only child, and he did not have any children himself. So the question is, she has some relatives that want to make a claim to her assets, and similarly, he has some relatives who want to make a claim to the assets. And the question is, what happens with her assets? If she passed away first, then this Reuven, the son who passed away, also would inherit her, and therefore his inheritors would have a claim not only to his assets, but also to his mother's assets. So nafal habayis alav va'al imo. This calamity occurred. The building collapsed on the Reuven and also on his mother. Elu ve'elu modim shiachloku. To distinguish this Mishnah from the prior two, where Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai disagreed, here the Tanakhama says that Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel would agree that in our situation, both the claimants, the descendants, inheritors of the son, and the inheritors of the mother have equal claims. They're on equal footing. So Beis Hillel would agree with Beis Shammai that when you have mammon in a safek, it's unclear who owns it, yachloku, they would divide it up. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva says, I disagree, just like they disagreed in the prior two Mishnayah, so too, Moda Ani Bazeh, Shanachaschim Becheskason, so too here, Beis Hillel would disagree, and you have to look at the Nechasim who had the Chazaka of ownership, who was in possession, and before this accident, the mother was in possession of the assets, and in other words, the default inheritors would be her family from her father. If she has relatives via her father, they would be the inheritors, and she's the muchzak. So we would not say simply divide it between the two groups. This would go to her relatives via her father. Amar lo ben Azai. Ben Azai comes and says, Rabbi Akiva, I disagree with you. I agree with the Tanakama that here, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel agree together. Even Beis Hillel would agree that you simply divide the assets. And I'll tell you, says Ben Azai, al hachalukin anu mitzdarin. We have sorrow that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai had machlokas in the prior two Mishnayas. We don't like machlokas. Ela shabasa lachalok aleinu esashavim. And here, you want to make a machlokas between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel also in this third Mishnah. Why do that? We have a bona fide sheet of the Tanakhama that says that they are in agreement, and I happen to agree that they are in agreement, that even Beis Hillel would agree with Beis Shammai that these two groups of claimants can simply divide the assets between them.